Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony gets the second half of their season underway tomorrow evening with a concert featuring two masterwork symphonies, as well as a world-class guest conductor. James Judd has held conducting posts literally around the world, from the Lille National Orchestra in France to the Florida Philharmonic, to the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, to the New Zealand Symphony, where he's conductor emeritus. Judd has recorded extensively as well, from a series of recordings with New Zealand, which raised their international reputation, to a classic recording of Elgar's Symphony No. 1 with the Halle Orchestra, to last year's Decca recording with pianist Benjamin Grosvenor and the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic. He's currently the music director of the Little Orchestra Society in New York City. He's artistic director of the Miami Music Project, which uses music as an instrument for social transformation in some of South Florida's poorest neighborhoods. And he's principal conductor of the Asian Youth Orchestra. In fact, throughout Judd's career, he's worked with youth orchestras alongside the elite symphonies of the world. Well, Saturday night, he'll lead the Tulsa Symphony in two great works, Mozart's Symphony No. 40 and Prokofiev's Symphony No. 5. That's Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. And James Judd is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. James Judd, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We're very excited about your appearance with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. And this program is a really interesting program because you're really doing two major, major staples of the repertoire, the Mozart Symphony 40 and Prokofiev Symphony No. 5. What are your thoughts on the program?
I think it's brilliant. It was the idea of the musicians' artistic committee, and a couple of them were talking to me at the first rehearsal about what did I think. I think it's absolute genius because these two pieces, the two composers go so well together. You know, they share many things, classical things, orchestration, transparency, heart, you know, such a fluid variety of feelings and emotions, quickly turning from one thing to another, full of wit and humor as well as profoundly serious thoughts. So it's a beautiful program to play for the musicians. It's a beautiful program to conduct. And I think a very satisfying program to listen to.
You mentioned their similarities, but we have 150 years between them. And so obviously it's almost a completely different musical vocabulary.
Yeah, but they're not many notes. They share the same notes. Just put them in a slightly different order, I suppose. No, of course. But I think that's a lovely thing about programming, where you can juxtapose completely different things sometimes, as opposed to having the Beethoven night or the Brahms night, you know. And this is nice because the emphasis is on the musicians of the orchestra. No soloists, you know, we're there. It's to share this great symphonic repertoire. And as we know, the Mozart symphony is one of those three symphonies, late symphonies that he wrote with incredible speed. And originally people thought he never heard it, but it seems that he did. And as you know, we're doing the version with the clarinets. So he must have heard, I think, a performance that didn't have the clarinets, then had an opportunity of a performance with the Stadler brothers. So on clarinet. So he added clarinet parts, reworked the other wind parts, and that's the version we're doing. And it's such a, you know, the piece has such angst in it. It has such drive and I don't know what was going on in his soul, but it's all there in that symphony. Just the start, it's very disturbing, and G minor, you know, this key, it's an amazing piece. And the Prokofiev is also a disturbing piece, you know, written at a particularly important moment in history, in 1944, with the Russian battle, the victory with the Germans, and it was all going on at that time. And somehow, and he says it reflects the sort of noble character, doesn't he, of the human being. And the piece goes remarkably quickly from very serious, profound content. You feel Shostakovich there, who learned so much from Prokofiev, I think. And then you suddenly find the full of jokes, you know, wit and wonderful solos, that clarinet solo in the second movement, you know, it's so funny. And yet suddenly it becomes very cutting as well. It gets interrupted by fierce sort of slashing of the strings or percussion. You know, so it's never quite settled. Is it funny? Is it happy? Is it trying to tell us something about the war? Is it
or heroic?
Heroic.
Yeah. I mean, it's full of, and it's all of those.
It's all of those. All of those. Mm-hmm. It never settles into one thing or another.
And I wonder, as a conductor, you know, you have to think of the politics of the time, because Prokofiev was in and out of favor in 1944, he's back in Russia. He's in favor, but, you know, it's only for a musician, it's one wrong note and you're out of favor.
I mean, it's very tricky to know, isn't it, without having been there. But
is that something you think about?
I mean, that he wrote this at that composer's house, you know, where at that time Shostakovich was there, Glier was there, many others were there. And so he was favored. He'd been back in into Russia for quite a while at that point. So I guess he was okay. But I think, like with Shostakovich, there's something hidden behind the music that we feel is very disturbing and is very dissatisfied sometimes and trying to reach out to the world. And yes, I think as a conductor, as a performer, you do need to absorb history, you know, as much as you can and learn the circumstances of the piece. And then when you come to perform, you learn the piece. When you come to perform it, you remember when I was Marzel's assistant, a very young, lowly assistant in Cleveland, my first job, which was phenomenal. And he told me that, you know, our job is to read history, look at the art from the time, study the composer's life, everything around him, study, of course, the notes, memorize those, know them backwards. Then rehearse hard. When you do the performance, you can sort of legitimately almost become the composer. You know, you must just let the piece flow.
You got to let his life sort of flow into yours.
Yes, just see what you've absorbed. And I don't think there should be any barriers when you perform. You should just let all of that work will guide you.
Hmm. Is there a moment in the Sixth Symphony that just really is one of those moments you wait for as a conductor? I know that's such a trite question, because in this particular piece and in both the symphonies, each one of these movements works in and of themselves. I mean, they can stand alone by themselves.
Well, there are so many things in the Prokofiev, so many moments that are quite extraordinary, you know, thinking of the end of the second movement, which was so frenzied, actually. I think of the very abrupt ending of the symphony. You think we're leading to this sort of huge flag-waving climax, and suddenly everything dissolves.
It almost disappears, and then boom.
Almost disappears, and then it comes back so fast. And so you're not sure, is it finished? Is there no more? In the slow movement, so many beautiful moments with poignant and mellifluous solos and extraordinary creatures in the background, you know, with Prokofiev. Every note on every instrument is perfectly managed and weighed and is conveying something, some psychological feeling. So that movement is eerie, I think, and maybe the center of the symphony, that the heart of the symphony, the, you know, the ending of that is so beautiful, the clarinet just slowly winding down. I don't know that there's Barbarolli, a great Sir John Barbarolli, English conductor, always used to say about Mahler symphonies, you had to find the one climax, you know, and to
and that's a difficult piece in the Prokofiev,
and that's difficult, I think, and he's probably right in a way about every symphony. I'm not sure. Certainly, every movement. I think you've got to, as a performer, see the last note. It's an old cliche, but it is true. I think the moment you start the first, you have to, you know where the direction goes, then you can be free within. And so you have to have a sense of structure, even if you don't say, well, this is the moment we're driving for necessarily.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the end, that, as we mentioned, that it winds down and then it winds back up, and it, almost before you know it, the Symphony No. 5 is over. Let's hear the ending of the Symphony No. 5 here on Studio Tulsa with my guest, James Judd, who is guest conducting the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's concert this Saturday night at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. That's music by Prokofiev from the Symphony No. 5, one of two works to be conducted by my guest today, James Judd. He'll be also doing the Mozart Symphony No. 40. And in this piece, as I mentioned before, it's a perfect symphony. The form of the piece is impeccable, and yet each one of these four movements have its on their own particular quality. Yeah. The first and fourth sort of have a similar quality, but the second is so sublime, and I've heard it done almost dance-like, and others will draw out that sublime feeling. The third, you expect it to be lighter, and all of a sudden, it's just as strong as the first and fourth movement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think there is a consistency to it. I think there's a depth to each movement, that there's a thread that seems to flow, something very profound.
You think it's that drama's from his health, the fact that he wasn't going to be around much longer?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, we all conjecture about that. Yeah. But it's all about opera, about people, about characters, I think, all of his music in a way. About human drama, about real feeling. After all, although he's writing in classical style, he's feeling the same feelings that you and I feel today, or Mahler felt, or Shostakovich or Prokofiev felt. I mean, it's the same feelings. So interesting is how to portray those within the style of the piece. But there's no doubt, I mean, it's hard for us to imagine how he could have gone on producing ever better masterpieces after the Jupiter Symphony, the 40th, 39th, the Requiem, unfinished, of course. But it's hard to imagine, isn't it? It's like with Schubert in a way. You can't really... I mean, what would have happened?
What would happen after the night?
I just don't know. And did he have some sense of foreboding about that? Possibly. We just don't know. I mean, it's a very nice romantic thought. I mean, it helps us kind of understand the something that's inexplicable, this kind of genius, and where did music come from? I remember Stravinsky, when he wrote The Rite of Spring, he said that I was the vessel through which The Rite of Spring passed. And one has that sense with Mozart always, right? That I've seen manuscripts of his and in Vienna with a musicologist there who knows everything about Mozart's writing, and was showing me how Mozart just wrote effortlessly, you know, a flow of melody and then probably a bass line and then indications of harmony, and then came back later, filled it. You see this, that he was just there with his hand moving, and he was a vessel through which this music just arrived, and it was a great gift for all of us. And of course, as you hinted, this music can be played in so many different ways. And we're used to hearing the sort of older, big symphony versions, which are very fine. I mean, I think of those two famous versions of Toscanini and Furtwängler, where Furtwängler is, everybody would expect to be slow, but turns out to be so much faster that some people thought that there was a mistake, that the Toscanini was slower, that was actually conducted by Furtwängler. So you can have grand versions like Carl Böhm, Karajan, you know, these fantastic. And when you start to listen to them, because of the integrity of the performers, the greatness, I get totally convinced. And then I turn some other recording on. These days we can hear these masterful recordings of period instruments and great musicologist performers, great interpreters like John Elliott Gardner, Harnoncourt, Norrington, I mean, so many now, who convince us in a totally different way, often with tempi, which are perhaps faster, smaller orchestras, no vibrato often.
Yeah, just a brightness, different texture, brightness and lightness.
And we feel also that it couldn't be any other way. And I think that's the great thing about all music, is that there is no definitive version at all. There's no right or wrong. Well, maybe a few wrongs, but there are a lot of rights. And our job is just to hope we can get close to one of the rights, you know, and convince people.
Earlier, you were talking about Sir John Barbarolli saying there has to be one climax. And I was thinking of the first movement of the Prokofiev. It seems like there is a huge ending climax, probably 8 or 9, maybe 10, 12 times in that first movement. And by the time you get done with that first movement, I would say, I'm ready to quit.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. And when you listen to, I've listened to a few recordings over the centuries of this piece and heard some pretty amazing live performances. You listen to a conductor like Ravinsky, let's say, just take for one. There are others as well to whom this applies, with the Leningrad Philharmonic in those times. You will hear that forte doesn't mean loud. You know, so if you actually take what Prokofiev has written very carefully, it's tricky. Try to balance. So there's a big difference between mezzo forte, forte, you know, and you will find there are fewer climaxes, less noise, and right. more music. So our challenge is to try to achieve that, because you're right, there's such intensity, and that final, those final pages, I mean, it's actually ferocious. But if you're able to restrain yourself, and I find it very difficult to do that, but if I'm able to restrain myself, and thus the orchestra is kind enough to restrain as well, without losing intensity, I think you can deliver those last pages as the climax of
and
that movement.
And that's where it needs to be.
So that's the trick, I think, of a successful performance of that movement, probably, of the symphony in general.
My guest today is James Judd. He is his music directorships include a principal guest conductor of the Lille National Orchestra, 14 years at the Florida Philharmonic. He is still the conductor emeritus or music director emeritus at the New Zealand Symphony. And currently he is leading the Little Orchestra Society in New York and the music director of the Asian Youth Orchestra, among others.
Principal conductor.
Principal conductor, excuse me.
Principal, yes, principal, that's what I am. They have a wonderful music director. His name is Richard Pontius, who started that orchestra nearly 25 years ago. Amazing.
And that is youth musicians from all across the Southeast Asia? And,
yes,
and
that's right. We have 14, 15 nationalities, territories. And they meet every year for 3 weeks rehearsal in Hong Kong and then 3 week tour all over Asia, different venues. And the orchestra is an amazing group of musicians. And technically, of course, what we have to work hard on is getting the introducing them to some of the ideas of phrasing and style of composers. But I've done, you know, Mahler 5, Mahler 9, Rachmaninoff 2. We've done Brahms Symphony. I mean, it's astonishing. How they respond. And the beginning, you know, it's a bit raw. Technically not. They can play all the notes, but then they work every day with great section leaders from principals of major orchestras all over the world. And so by the end of 6 weeks, it's pretty astonishing what they achieve and the love they have for playing together and the love of the music.
Well, one of the things I was impressed with, looking at your credits, I mean, you have perform with all the major orchestras, major opera companies, had great music directorships, acclaimed recordings. But when I look at what you're doing now, most all of your permanent positions at this point, other than guest conducting, is really geared towards mentoring children, either as youth orchestras or a whole music educational system like you're doing in Miami, or like the Little Orchestra, which is geared towards family concerts.
Well, yeah, I mean, the most recent thing I'm very pleased about, the Little Orchestra Society, when you look back at the history of that organization, 1947, so it's the second oldest union orchestra in New York. 1947, it was doing premieres of Strauss operas in the U.S.
Wow.
It was doing Berlioz, Beatrice, and Benedict first performance in the U.S. It was Copland was there working with the Orchestra of Britain. It was doing so many commissions and U.S. premieres, world premieres, American premieres.
Now, was the Aaron Copland Little Symphony, was that written for that group?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. You caught me out.
Oh, well,
I'll go and check that out. But, you know, then they started to do more and more family concerts and made a real mark, actually, doing series for very young children from 3.
Yeah, I was going to say 5 and under. One of the series is for 5 and under.
It's a beautiful series at Hunter College at the K Playhouse. And they have visuals as well as about 14-piece orchestra. We play really good music and just introduce them. And that's something that has a great tradition in New York. You see families, you know, parents and grandparents who remember those concerts, and that's very important. Then we have a series for the slightly older children at Avery Fisher, at Tully Hall. We have a beautiful program in schools getting kids compose music. And they want to look at the whole organization. I'm interested at doing more contemporary music. I'm interested in, and everyone in the organization now is interested to see how we can build more adult programs as well. Not to give up our children's, not at all, to you know, expand those, but to
sort of reclaim your roots in a way.
And it's, for me, you know, there's no difference between, you know, truly no difference between young orchestras, young musicians, professionals, same with audience. You know, music is music. And if you can find musicians that are willing to play with life and love, it doesn't matter whether they're young or old or audiences either. So I'm interested to see how we can contribute in a small way there to bringing back young adults into the concert hall, maybe looking for different venues, sometimes with a bigger orchestra. I mean, we just before Christmas, we did my first concert there. We put the little symphony orchestra into the Big Top.
Oh, the Big Apple Circus.
Yes, the Big Apple Circus. And we played a whole Haydn symphony. We had two composers, Daniel Romain and David Little. We did New York premieres of their pieces. Did some Strauss. We did had a couple of actors there. And it was wonderful, you know, just to have, for example, a Haydn symphony surrounded by all that music and in this strange place with beautiful lighting. Think you hear Haydn in a different way. And so we want to experiment sanely a little bit in directions like that. So it's an interesting position, which I've just started. And it's a team of people who are so enthusiastic to try to create, you know, musical events for all ages.
Now, I want to talk about the Miami Music Project. Mm-hmm. You were in South Florida for many years, doing opera for a few years, as well as the Florida Philharmonic for a number of years. And I guess you have some roots there now. Mm-hmm. And this, tell us a little about this Miami Music Project, because this is really taking the whole, well, you know, the National Youth Orchestra of Venezuela and that whole system that they have there, and trying to do that in South Florida, I assume among mm-hmm. equally impoverished communities mm-hmm. in South Florida.
Well, I was lucky enough to take part at a music festival when I was assistant of Claudio Abbado years and years ago. It was in 1975 or 6. And it was a festival of youth orchestras in Scotland. And Abbado was conducting the big international orchestra. There were participating orchestras, one of which was the Venezuelan Youth Orchestra. And a fine young gentleman at that point, Jose Antonio Abreu, who's started this El Sistema. He told us that he was going to be doing this work. And we thought, what? It sounds very unlikely. And as you know, he started with 11 young musicians in the garage, and now it's nearly half a million kids playing music. And, you know, the profound effect it has in terms of esteem as a social transformative project for kids, for communities, for families. And of course, unfortunately, in this country, in every country in the world, but certainly I can speak for South Florida, we have these areas of extreme deprivation, and where kids are fighting to receive a proper education, and teachers are fighting through the system to teach kids properly, not just facts, but how to join facts, so that, you know, we listen more to one another, we're less afraid of one another, we communicate better with one another. And music is, of course, a wonderful way of doing that, joining the parts of the brain, giving kids who have nothing otherwise in their lives often, their families, very tricky circumstances, yeah, giving them something to do. So we have a program 3-4 times a week after school in two areas at the moment. Not all totally impoverished areas by any means, but that's another thing I feel important is this is a program for everybody. And we're just about to open at the end of January in another area in collaboration with other organizations. And thanks to the whole project, it works thanks to a huge matching grant we received 4 years ago to start with by the Knight Foundation. And they're doing astonishing work in many cities in giving backing to people and ideas, making difference in society. And that's my belief, that if everybody can listen and play and love music, they really are going to learn to be more generous to one another. Because even at the very beginning, when they sit in the class before they get an instrument, the very young ones, and they're just learning to sit quietly and on demand, so to speak, be given a cue and start to learn some rhythms, there's a discipline, and there's a sense of having to listen to one another, to join in, to give a little bit. And we know that's what
that helps in every aspect of life.
That's right. I mean, that's what all great orchestral playing is, coincidentally. Of course, it's not about following a conductor's piece of wood. It's about listening to one another. It's chamber music. That's the art of great orchestral playing. And as you rightly say, this program is not geared towards turning out musicians any more than it was in Venezuela, though, of course. By definition, you end up turning out these geniuses and wonderful conductors like Dudamel and players now in Berlin Philharmonic. All over the world, there are Venezuelan players as a result. But it's much deeper than that. It goes right into the community. It gives a sense of worth, a sense of esteem, a sense of the significance of an individual who otherwise might be thrown away by society.
Now, this is entering its, I guess, sixth year. Is that correct?
God, I think it is.
2008?
Probably is. It's amazing how things go flying past.
Are you starting to see some great results?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm fortunate that I supervise it from afar. I have a most wonderful board of directors. I have a wonderful program director from Venezuela, conductor, composer, and fabulous teachers and most marvelous administrators. Everybody, so clever. So it's their work now. I try to help with fundraising and do a little bit conducting here and there when I'm in town. But it's very satisfying to see the growth. And there are lines of musicians waiting to join the program. It's just a question of finding money. And I know that there are programs or will be programs here in Tulsa. There are programs all over the world now of this nature. And I do recommend them to anyone who feels like supporting anywhere, because it's a very beautiful thing to see young people. And we have to keep track for the grants we receive of their scores in other classes at school, the effect. And we can say, as you can read about it from all over the world, the effect that it has, learning music, on children's, all of our brains, and the effect that it has on their studies in mathematics, other subjects, is remarkable and definable, as well as the fact that it's going to turn everyone into better citizens. And so I think it's hugely important. It's probably been really, when you look objectively at the world of education, this has probably been the most important and significant thing that's happened in education worldwide in the last 2 decades.
My guest today is James Judd. He'll be leading the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in a program of Mozart and Prokofiev this Saturday night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. I wish you great success with that program and all of your conducting endeavors, whether it's finding new audiences for the Little Symphony or a new audience here in Tulsa for the Symphony. We appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I appreciate the invitation.
Guest conductor James Judd is my guest today. He'll be guest conducting the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's concert featuring the symphonies by Mozart and Prokofiev tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For more information on the concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory, and we're going to leave you with the opening of the finale of Mozart's Symphony No. 40. I'm Rich Fisher.